What is it?
It's me, Mr. Pensler.
You, this must be my unlucky day. Kid, we've been through this before. You just don't got what it takes to write for large print hard-boiled detective stories, the number one pulp fiction magazine for far-sighted folks.
Please, Mr. Pensler, I've been reading all the back issues of large print hard-boiled detective stories, and I think I get what you're looking for.
Okay, what do you got?
All right, how about this one? Dirt Nap for Mr. Confucius.
I hear potential. Read a little bit to me.
After a mysterious stranger blackjacked my uncle, I needed a clean slate. That's how I found myself living in the Seedmoor Hotel on the edge of the Tenderloin District. I had two best friends, my .45 automatic and a bottle of Old Vulture whiskey substitute. It was another chilly day.
Stop, you're killing me. That's terrible, kid.
What's wrong with it?
Too many words. Here at Large Print Hardboiled Detective Stories, our readers want you to get to the point. Shock, panic, car noise, big heart slam, boom boom, lights out.
I could put in more stuff like that, Mr. Pensler.
More stuff like that? Kid, you're missing the point. I just read you a whole story. That was Farewell My Monkey by Murray Champion. Now that's a large print detective story.
Can I read you some of this one? A Clean Towel for Sister Snooky?
No, I already know I hate it. Kid, it's 1938. People are busy. The readers of Large Print Hardboiled Detective Stories, they want Stranglers in the Night by Huge Cornbelt. They want Please Omit Bullets by Earl Frankie Casey. They want Your Blood Type or Mine by John D. Studebaker. The only people who got time to read your F. Scott Flaubert crap is maybe somebody with a broken leg, stuck in a wheelchair, staring across the alley at other people's windows.
Wait, say that again.
I already forgot it.
Mr. Pensler, I gotta go. I think I got an idea for a great detective story. Okay, a photographer with a broken leg, stuck in a wheelchair, staring across the alley at other people's windows. A pretty young English woman living in France forms a romantic attachment and becomes a suspect in the theft of a jeweled snuff box in the shape of a pocket watch said to have belonged to Napoleon. Meanwhile, wealthy art connoisseur Dwight Stanhope and his daughters, sensible Betty and neurotic Eleanor, have invited...
I can hear you out there, kid. Too much plot.
He's right. I could probably cut one of the daughters. I think I'll call the story Lethal Encore for the Devil's Bargain from Limbo.
Too long.
Or maybe just Rear Window. Listen to this radio show. I gotta go write. And now he plays Merle the Nurse and Ding Dong You're Dead, Colin McEnroe.
All right. So, in fact, the beloved property, fictional property that we call Rear Window, did start in exactly that kind of an environment, in those kinds of pulp magazines that were, well, actually, this the one in question is was called Dime Detective. We're going to tell you about this. But what we want to do, why we're doing this, maybe that's where I should begin, why we're doing this is because, of course, at the Hartford Stage, Kevin Bacon is starring in a different version of Rear Window. And it's so popular that we hate even to mention it to you because you can't go. Actually, I guess there's some standing room tickets that are maybe still available in between now and when it closes on Sunday the 15th. But it sold out almost immediately, partly on the star power of Kevin Bacon, partly on the appeal of this story because it's a story everybody knows or thinks that they know. It can be told several different ways, as we're going to discover here. So we're going to tell you a little bit about the enduring popularity of this story and why does Rear Window make people's eyes light up. And we're also going to talk to you about the arc of this story, what it has existed as in its different iterations. And we're also going to talk very specifically about what the Hartford Stage production is getting at, maybe getting at a whole bunch of new sensibilities or old sensibilities that marry the original version of it to its author. And that sounds a little mysterious. We'll explain it in just a second. Let me tell you who's participating in the show today. Down the line in the NPR studios in Manhattan is Keith Radin. He wrote the Hartford Stage's current adaptation of Rear Window. In studio with me are the producers of that adaptation, Charlie Lyons and Jay Russell. And then joining us by phone is film critic and film historian David Thompson, the author of more than 30 books on film, including most recently, like last week, it came out, How to Watch a Movie. So in just a second, we're going to just spend a little bit of time with the movie. That's the Rear Window that most of you know best. But Charlie, maybe just for starters here, you could explain the different ways this thing existed. So what was it at first? First of all, it wasn't even called Rear Window at the beginning.
Well, Cornell Woolrich, who wrote under a variety of names, including William Irish and George Hopley, is considered to be one of the great mystery writers, one of the great noir writers of all time. And I believe Frank can probably tell us whether this claim is accurate, but he is said to have had more titles adapted to the screen than any other crime novelist. And so I was just sort of scanning a list, Convicted, Street of Chance, Leopard Man, Phantom Lady, Black Angel, Rear Window. Also, It Had to Be Murder. It had a couple of different titles.
And one thing we should say is, so the kind of magazine that Dime Detective was, so this story, It Had to Be Murder, appeared in Dime Detective 1942. And
right.
And if you look at the covers of those magazines, they look kind of cheesy, tawdry. There are these, you know, very vampy looking pictures of some guy with a gun in his undershirt, and there's a beautiful woman, and there's something a little bit formulaic and seedy about it. But in fact, some really great writers were writing for Dime Detective and its compatriots, including Raymond Chandler, right? I mean,
that's right.
Lady in the Lake originally appeared as a story in Dime Detective.
That's right. And, you know, Cornell was a very complicated guy. Mm. You know, his setups were very exciting to us as storytellers. And obviously, Keith, you know, had enormous skill in this area. But it was always amnesia, discomfort, darkness, you know, a little bit of blood, a body that you didn't recognize, a location that was unfamiliar, and an impending sense of doom. And so it was a fantastic setup.
And so Keith Radin, before we go to David Thompson, Keith Radin, so this original story, this story written by Cornell Woolrich, it was called It Had to Be Murder, and it had some of the elements that people know from Rear Window, right? What was the story? What did Cornell Woolrich write about?
Well, he was basically writing the plot of the murder mystery, a man stuck in a chair, and you don't even find out until the last sentence why he's stuck in that chair. Observes something across the way, across the courtyard, what he thinks is a murder, and becomes convinced that he's seen something terrible happen, becomes somewhat obsessed with it, and then tries to convince everyone around him that, you know, what he's seen has actually happened. But in that story, that protagonist, we know nothing about him. He offers information about everyone else around him, but nothing about himself. So we don't know really who he is, how he got there, what his background is, what job he has, if any, how long he's been there. So the story really gave us a lot of leeway in terms of writing a stage noir and filling in a lot of that with a modern sensibility.
Right. There's actually, to your point, your original point there, there's kind of a cute reveal at the end. Throughout the story, we hear these references to, I was hopscotching across the room, or I wasn't used to being immobile, or something like that, you know, or I didn't know how to fill my time. But he doesn't tell you why. And then at the end, spoiler alert, but at the end, the doctor comes to cut it. After he's had all this incredible adventure, the doctor says, well, I guess it's time to cut your cast off that broken leg so you can get busy, you know, no more sitting around idly or something. So there's this little cute reveal about the broken leg. I want to come back to the story, what it's about, who Woolrich was, because that's very important to the new production of this. But let's quickly journey over to David Thompson, as I say, film critic, film historian, author of 30 books or more about film, including How to Watch a Movie, which came out this week. And in fact, there's a chunk of this book that's devoted to Rear Window, and Grace Kelly herself can be seen gazing out from the cover. So we're right on point here. David Thompson, how does this movie stand? Well, actually, let me ask a different question. This movie, which came out, I think, in 1954, the same year as Dial M for Murder, why did it grab people? What were the qualities of it that made it this enduring masterpiece?
Well, I think it's a very good suspense mystery film. It's also got elements of a romance, even some comedy. And I think because there is wonderful chemistry between James Stewart and Grace Kelly, who play the central couple, and also I think because there's real chemistry between Hitchcock and Grace Kelly. And I think the other thing, and I think this is what really motivated Hitchcock, It really is a movie about watching, about voyeurism, and about movie going. He took the story, and I think he was excited by the visual dynamic of the courtyard and the several windows that the hero is looking at, which are all like movie screens. And I think he sees it as a kind of metaphor for the way we are looking at movie screens, too. Beyond that, I would say that it is simply still, years later, a wonderfully accomplished, entertaining, suspenseful, satisfying movie. It's one of my favorite Hitchcock films, and I don't think it's dated at all.
I'm going to push back against what you said a little bit, or not push back against it, but maybe suggest an additional way of thinking about it. It's certainly a movie about watching and about the way we watch movies, the way we watch people watching in movies. It's about all those things. Hitchcock himself said it's very much about the way that people are just naturally peeping Toms, that, you know, everybody likes to look at everybody else. I think it also might be, maybe subconsciously, maybe not a conscious choice by Hitchcock, about television. It's 1954, so there's 10 million or more TV sets in the United States. The world has kind of changed that way, and you can choose what screen you want to look at. And one of the things that's happening with Jimmy Stewart's character is he can see all of these different quote-unquote programs. He can see Ross Bagdasarian there playing the piano, and he can see the pneumatic woman, young woman dancing, and the newlyweds and the older people and their dog. He can pick the program he wants to watch, and he ultimately settles, obviously, on this dark and dangerous and upsetting thing that he wants to watch. But in some ways, he's kind of watching television. I don't know.
Well, I think that's a very interesting, fair point. Something you leave out is that as the story develops, the conflict between the different channels, if you take my point, that he's watching becomes acute because he's intensely involved with the murderer's window, if you like, when he realizes that maybe a woman in one of the other windows is on the point of committing suicide and something should be done to help her. So that the level of suspense and conflict gets really quite complicated. Another thing is that in the movie, the Grace Kelly character wants to get Stewart to marry her. And in virtually every window they look at, there is a different stage of marriage being depicted. It's very cleverly, amusingly organized in that way.
Right. And in a way, I think you sort of point this out in the book, in a way, they almost have to overcome the darkness of the Thorwald marriage in order to, she slips on the Thorwald ring.
Crucial plot moment.
Yeah. In a way, they're sort of saying, you know what? Yes, some marriages really go south and people kill each other, but we're going to get married anyway.
Hitchcock is doing that in a very ironic way. And I think that one of the reasons I like this film so much is that it's a little bit lighter than, say, a film like Vertigo. And I like Hitchcock when he's being amusing, too.
The other thing that that I would say is, or wonder about anyway, David Thompson, is whether this movie is also a little bit about post-war, anxiety might not be the right word, anxiety slash curiosity about one's neighbors. So World War II happens, people come back. And they don't always come back to the same place that they left. More of them settled in cities. More people come into the United States from other places. And so you have people, when we go back to the Woolridge story with Keith and the producers here, we can talk a little bit about what's in that. But 1942 is a different time. In 54, you've got these urban environments where your neighbors are different from you. You know, they're living very different lives. And so life is less homogenized.
I think that's a bit of a reach.
Okay.
I think Hitchcock was interested in the dynamics of movie making, not very much interested in the construction of society. One thing about the movie, in hindsight, if you think that it's set in Manhattan, it's a very, very white film, mm-hmm. which I don't think would be the same today if you were to redo it. I take the point about there being an allusion to TV. The other point you make, I don't feel that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, my reach should exceed my grasp, and my grasp was always shaky. We're talking to David Thompson right now, who wrote most recently How to Watch a Movie. So one of the other points that you make is that, you know, there's the bones of the story that Cornell Woolrich gives us. There's Hitchcock's vision of the story. But then there's sort of everybody else. And for you, Grace Kelly, in a way, makes this movie into, I mean, obviously Jimmy Stewart's also just, you know, a very witty, engaging presence. But Kelly, in a way, can sell things in this movie that nobody put there in the first place.
Well, you know, there's a very important aspect to it, very obvious, but she moves. Stewart is immobile. He is in a wheelchair almost all the time. She moves around. She's the one who goes over to the apartment when the murderer is out and tries to find a clue. She climbs up the fire escape, climbs into the window. She's the active person in the film, and active people in films always get a little more sympathy and a little more attention, I think. And, you know, that is Grace Kelly at her peak, and she's beautifully dressed in the film. She plays a fashion model. She was dressed for the film by Edith Head. The clothes are very good. John Michael Hayes, who did the screenplay, gives her very funny lines. And, of course, her character is not in the short story at all.
Right, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about who's there instead, and then who's there on the stage version. And there's a way in which, you know, just to go back to one of your earlier points, that this is a story about marriage, about people deciding to get married, that this adventure, I think the Jimmy Stewart's Jeff suddenly sees this woman in a different way, that she's not just ornamental.
Yeah, no, I think he's won over. And you're left with the conclusion that they are going to get married. Whether he will continue to be a photographer who travels the world shooting dangerous things, that's an open question. But we feel they're going to be together.
Right. I mean, because, in fact, he's learned to sit still. That's the other thing. I mean, he's not great at it, but he's learned to sit still. All right, David Thompson, so great to talk to you. So great to get that perspective on the movie. David Thompson's new book is How to Watch a Movie. It's about a lot of movies, including Rear Window. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk to the rest of our guests here about the short story and how it made its way onto the stage.
Jimmy Stewart, you were a man of peculiar habits. You had a wonderful life.
All right, welcome back to our show about Rear Window. Rear Window has been a bunch of different things. It started out as a short story by a different name in a sort of pulp fiction magazine. Then it became an acclaimed Hitchcock movie. Now it's playing at the Hartford Stage Company with Kevin Bacon through November 15th, but I shouldn't even be mentioning this to you because you probably can't go, although there are a limited number of standing room tickets possibly available. I've seen it. I recommend it, but for reasons that we will now go into quite a bit over the rest of the show, I caution you about showing up with expectations that are based on Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly, because this is a very, very different production. So, by the way, as we go along here, either of you seen the stage production or you have feelings about the story itself and its enduring hold on us, you can give us a call at 860-275-7266. We're live here in the afternoon, 860-275-7266. And, of course, as usual, you may tweet at us. We encourage you to tweet at us at WNPR Colin, where Greg Hill, our tweet master, is awaiting your tweets. And he's tweeting himself already. All right. So, Jay Russell, let's get you involved. One of the producers a Rear Window at Hartford Stage. It's kind of an interesting thing. One of our producers here, Jonathan McNichol, pointed out Dial M for Murder and Rear Window, the movies, came out at the same time, our same year, 54, quite a year, quite a home run year for Hitchcock. Dial M for Murder had been a stage play. They both have, as Jonathan says, they both seem like plays in a way. You know, the Rear Window of the movie seems like a play on the surface of it. And then you realize, for all these David Thompson reasons, that it's really more a movie about movies, about editing, shooting, angles, stuff like that. It's not really naturally a play. So how did you guys decide it was going to be a play?
Well, first of all, that's a very good point in that I think that Rear Window, the film, is one of the most cinematic pieces of work I've ever seen, because there are long passages in that movie where there's no dialogue whatsoever. It's extremely cinematic. In this case, I think in every creative endeavor, there's always that spark of an idea, you know, the conceptual Big Bang. And in this case, you know, I mean, and it can come from anywhere. You hear a piece of music and it reminds you of something, or it's a conversation. And in this case, it was, you know, has there ever been a stage version of the short story called Rear Window, or It Had to Be Murder? And with a little investigation, you know, we found out not. You know, and an idea is nothing unless you act upon it. Mm-hmm. And so this was a case where there was an idea. Then I spoke to it with Charlie. I spoke to it with Keith Redeen, and it confirmed this notion that this is a good idea. So that's kind of where it started, was just a spark of an idea of had this ever been put on stage. And then the process of making it its own original piece, that was the just really fun and wonderful and creative process with Charlie and Keith on this.
And so, Charlie, there were even some questions about who actually owned this, right? This title has a very complicated provenance in terms of who owns the rights.
Sure. You know, for us, it's simple that when you go to try and get the rights, acquire the rights to something, you get a very clear determination as to who controls them. You know, it's interesting. Before we came on the show, we were looking at all the various short stories that had found their way to the screen, everything from Annabelle Lee, you know, Edgar Allan Poe, App Pupil. This is just the A's and B's, Bicentennial Man, The Body Snatcher, Breakfast at Tiffany's. You can go right down the list. And so, you know, for us, it was simple to get the rights to the short story, and then you're confined to what that short story is. The beauty of this, it was essentially 20 pages. It left enormous blanks. And so you bring in somebody like Keith Redeen, and you get to expand it in every direction and make it something completely original, because Cornell had this magnificent way of leaving a lot up to the imagination.
But Jay Russell, there was also some guy who bought up rights to things, right?
I'm sorry.
There was some guy who bought up rights to things, and he got the rights to Rear Window for some bargain basement price.
Well, that gets into a whole area of technicalities that, frankly, we never really went into that much. Mm-hmm. I mean, we simply wanted to know, is this something that we can pursue? Mm-hmm. And if we had been told no, well, then that would have been, again, back to my point, then that would have been an idea that, oh, okay, oh, well. But we were told this is something we can pursue because it exists as its own piece of work, and we found that piece of work fascinating. And again, with no offense towards the film at all, we just felt this was a piece of material worth adapting for the stage, and that's how we pursued it.
So let's talk about that adaptation process. So Keith Redeen, when you came in, at some point, clearly from what we see on stage, you decided to fuse the story that Cornell Woolrich wrote with the story of Cornell Woolrich. Explain for people who don't know what I'm talking about what is meant by that.
Well, Cornell Woolrich was a really fascinating, dark person. He started off writing very kind of slick, sophisticated novels of the F. Scott Fitzgerald mode about the beautiful young people of the lost generation. But then felt that was ultimately not satisfying or where he wanted to go. And he was fascinated by the dark side of human existence. You know, he was a loner. And then doing research on him, because I was so fascinated by his work and the darkness in his work and the noir atmosphere that he creates, found out that even though he had a very short marriage, that he was a repressed homosexual, and that, you know, ultimately for the rest of his life, he became an alcoholic. And at first he lived with his mother in various hotel rooms and then ended up the rest of his life living alone. And a crazy, ironic thing happened that after writing It Had to Be Murder, A Rear Window, and a number of these stories, towards the end of his life when he's alone in this hotel room, not taking care of himself, that he had gangrene with his foot and then had to have his foot amputated and ended up the end of his life alone in a room, stuck in a chair, because of what happened to his leg, staring out the window, watching people. And I thought that kind of came full circle in a very strange, eerie, wonderful way of that his life became Rear Window in an odd way. But there were so many aspects of his darkness, of his disturbing life that was in his material. And I really felt like looking at the story today that if he was alive and had the freedom to write about the various social, sexual, economic, political things that are going on now and had that freedom, he would write this stage version.
Yeah, and so let's go back to the story itself because it's kind of interesting what goes on there. So the bones of what we know about Rear Window, a lot of them are right there in the short story, but it is a slightly different feel from what Hitchcock does. And right from the start, even the neighborhood itself is kind of different, right? The narrator, Jeff, is saying, well, there were houses I could see, right? He's in what sort of feels more like a house. I think he talks about a bay window out the back of his bedroom, and he says there are houses that he can see, and he decides that most of them aren't that interesting. And then there's this one building that he can see, and he says the other houses were more like furnished rooms that people were renting. This building was built for more as an apartment building, a building of flats, I think he calls it, and it. I think one of the things that propels noir fiction or propelled noir fiction in its peak era was that notion that around you, dark things might be happening. You know, if you looked in the right window or the wrong window, you might see something. And I think there's that sort of sense, once again, it's of him looking at these various buildings and then suddenly seeing this thing that he can't stop looking at. How did that resonate with you?
Well, I think that inside we're all peeping Toms, whether we want to acknowledge it or not. Huh. And I think that Cornell Woolrich, in his genius, said that we all have that impulse. And given the fact that we might be stuck in one place, we would be seeing something and obviously becoming fascinated. Getting to your point of like if we were looking at all those television screens, we, whether we want to admit it or not, have a tendency to be drawn to the lurid, you know, the violent, the darkness. And so that's what we're going to be watching. And if you're stuck there and have nothing else to look at, you know, there is the danger that you become obsessed with it. The other fact that, as you mentioned in the story, as opposed to the Hitchcock, nothing against the Hitchcock movie, which is wonderful and delightful and charming and suspenseful all on its own. But that's about a world that Hitchcock creates of glamour. And it's not really a noir film. And we were all very interested in creating a stage noir, which again is about darkness, is about characters living on the edge. And I felt like the description in the story of the inhabitants of that building, of their social class, of that neighborhood, was a much darker, much grittier world than the world of Hitchcock.
I think a point that Hitchcock makes at some point about his movie is that in some ways, cutting back to Jimmy Stewart based on what he's seeing, you realize that what you see changes you, right? If you're watching a little dog be lowered in a basket, and you're smiling and stuff like that, then you, the watcher, are participating in something that's kind of cute or sweet. If you're watching Miss Torso up there gyrating, then suddenly maybe you're kind of more of a peeping Tom or a dirty old man or whatever it is, that what you watch changes you. I feel like in the Woolrich thing, that's sort of there, but certainly in your play, Keith Rudine, what's there is, no, we already have our darkness in us. In other words, Jeff, as a watcher, is already full of an incredible amount of darkness that's almost just being mirrored back to him by what he looks at.
Yeah, but I think that Cornell Woolrich had that in him, which is, you know, aspects of that we brought into the character. But I would argue that all the people that bought all those dime, you know, Pulp Fiction magazines and read those stories and saw those noirs had that similar darkness, that what he was tapping into was that dark impulse that we all have in ourselves and that, as you said, is mirrored back to us. when we read those stories or see those films. And I felt like with Charlie and Jay, and we all agreed on this, that we wanted to go to that place to embrace it, the darkness, the voyeuristic, the peeping Tom that we all have within ourselves.
That was oddly contemporary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one thing I would add that makes Keith's adaptation unique, and it applies to what David mentioned earlier describing the film, is a big difference here is in the Hitchcock film, the Jimmy Stewart character is a very reliable narrator. Mm-hmm. He's right at the beginning, he's right at the middle, he's right at the end. And I think what's really interesting about Keith's adaptation, and not to give anything away, but I think that Keith's character, again, using the short story as a launching point, he creates a possibly unreliable character. And I think it increases the mystery then of is what we the audience are seeing on stage, is that an accurate depiction of what's actually happening, or is this coming from the unreliable narrator's mind? Is that right, Keith?
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that, again, not to get into too much comparison with the film, because he's using icons like Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly and, you know, literally a heavy like Raymond Burr, there's never a doubt in the audience's mind that he is correct, that this murder actually happened, and that he's going to get the girl at the end. What I find exciting about this stage version, and audiences have said this over and over again, is when they come in and they watch the stage version, very quickly they see this is not the story that they think they know. And about halfway through, as Jay and Charlie have said, you know, he becomes an unreliable narrator to the point which we have much greater suspense because we don't know how it's going to turn out. And for all we know, maybe he's wrong.
I just want to get back to that point about icons, and I know we don't want to sit here making all kinds of comparisons, but I think it's inevitable that one of the things that happens, and Jay Russell, I'm going to start with you on this, is, you know, maybe even more than you might have imagined going into this project, people are bringing their iconic notions in with them. And so I will now be the only person to make an analogy or a comparison between the stage version of Rear Window and the movie The Martian. So here's my so
that's a great one. Yeah,
are you ready
for that?
Are you ready? Okay. So the Martian is sometimes is a genre that now gets described sometimes as competence porn. You know, that it's about highly competent people dealing with a situation really effectively. You know, everybody's kind of smart. It's one of those Aaron Sorkin things, right? People are really smart. They talk really well. They think really well. They get these horrible problems and they solve them. And the film version of Rear Window is a little bit of competence porn too, in the sense that, wow, he's like stuck in a wheelchair, you know, and she's never done anything like this. They crack this case, you know, and then they deal with this murderer. And so Jay, you know, in Keith's version, there's a violation of that covenant, right? I mean, not only is Jeff an unreliable narrator, he's just really flawed, you know, he's fragile. He's pre-broken in some ways. It's not just his leg that's broken. There's all kinds of other stuff that's broken in him. And so you kind of are my sense the night that I saw it was that the audience was really struggling a little bit against these two things. I mean, I think Kevin Bacon is really great in this play. I think he's terrific. But boy, I feel like he has to vault over Jimmy Stewart to get us to see, oh no, this isn't going to be competence porn.
Oh, well. First of all, and I mean, to your very last point, I think it's a real comment on how good Kevin is in this play. The fact that he can, in a very short amount of time, take the audience away from thinking about this other portrayal of a similar character. They're not the same character because, as you say, in our portrayal of Jeffries, he has been a very competent reporter. But I think this broken leg suggests, as you said, the broken leg suggests that now that he's holed up in this apartment, he's going very internal, and so the competence level is decreasing as the longer he's stuck in this apartment, and so I think it's again just a real testament to what Kevin is doing is he makes us forget all of that and he draws us into this new character that is in a familiar situation.
And Charlie Lyons, have you gotten a sense of how audiences do react to this? I know from talking to some people, they really had a hard time with this.
My impression of the audience is that they've first of all, Hartford's a really sophisticated audience. It's mm-hmm. a great theater town. One person we're not mentioning here that is obviously a creative flashpoint with the whole thing and with our choice to be here and our choice to be with Hartford is we had this dream of creating sort of a graphic novel on stage that was shared with Darko. Mm-hmm. And Darko is an exceptionally skilled guy, someone that does huge scale operas in Los Angeles and all over the United States, as well as he's a Shakespearean scholar. So his depth of knowledge about human character and human behavior and how he portrays that and his willingness to sort of embrace things that are more complex about human character was what totally had us in, and I think was very exciting to the actors that are involved. So I think the audiences have had a uniformly positive but complicated reactions to it, because what it does is it exposes this idea that, well, we're all looking at things we shouldn't be looking at. And if we're all in a similar situation, no matter what kind of level of alpha character we might be in our real life, if we get laid up, our mind is liable to play tricks with us. And, you know, the outcome is confusing. And so I think it's been a very provocative piece of literature, I think, to Keith's skill and Darko's skill to transport people to a place, much like filmmakers like Alexander Iñárritu or Mike Nichols is able to do. They are willing to ask more complicated questions.
Oh, yeah, just to make that clear, Darko, of course, is Darko Treznik, who is the artistic director of the Hartford Stage Company. Probably something should be said about Alexander Dodge, too, the guy who created this set, which, I mean, I love your idea of it being a graphic novel on stage. It really is. And we won't give this away, but one of the questions you might have walking in there is how do you – because when you really think about it, back to that original point, in a way that Dial M for Murder can be staged and was staged, Rear Window has an immediate problem, which is that there are two important perspectives. The perspective within the apartment in which conversations are being had between Jeff and anybody else who comes in to see him, and then the outside that he's looking at. But you have to be able to get to that outside, and it's harder to do in a theatrical environment. So the way that gets solved is something we're not going to tell you other than to say the audience gasps the first time they see it. All right, so we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll finish up our conversation about Rear Window after this.
I hate to interrupt the flow of the show, but I have some exciting news. I'm engaged. I'm going to be the next Mrs. Lars Thorwald. He's a widower, and he seems very nice. Today's show was produced by Jonathan McNichol and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Nate Gagnon and Dan Schultz. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Thelma Ritter. For show pages, articles, and photos of the Here and Now staff jitterbugging in their apartment, visit our website, WNPR.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, Ask a Philosopher. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, actually, tomorrow's show, we're going to have some leading philosophers on. This is all suggested to me by Shelley Kagan on a podcast that we were on together, a podcast called Unorthodox, where he was saying, you know, I mean, every night on cable news and every day on talk radio, people argue all the time about right and wrong, you know, what's right, what's wrong, what's, you know, because really these people called philosophers, they're never on those shows, but they actually do have some kind of framework for thinking about those questions. How come we don't use them more? It's like we should have one behind glass, break glass in case of emergency, get the philosopher out. That's what we're going to do tomorrow. We're going to break that glass and bring our philosophers out and help us figure this stuff out. I also, in terms of thank yous, anytime I say to Betsy Kaplan, I got this. It's all under control. That means she's got like 2 hours of running around tie up loose ends for me. So Betsy Coughlin, as usual, has jumped in to save the day in lots of ways that I could never explain. All right. So we're talking about Rear Window, the adaptation that's at the Hartford Stage Company. Keith Radin is with us via the NPR studios in Manhattan. Charlie Lyons and Jay Russell, they're the producers of Rear Window at Hartford Stage. Keith Radin is the guy who wrote the adaptation. So Jay Russell, and we'll start with you, but we're talking during the break about the fact that one of the things we haven't talked about so far is in lieu of Grace Kelly, not exactly in lieu of Grace Kelly, and in a way that, we can go back to the story, this original story by Cornell Woolrich, which is like this, like, Edward Hopper painting come to life or something, we have this manservant, basically, named Sam. So we'll get to Keith in a second, but explain for people who don't know, who haven't seen the show, what Sam has turned into.
Well, as you say, in the short story, there is this character who is a servant, I put in quotation marks, named Sam, and just like Woolrich's writing of the whole piece, he leaves all kinds of room for interpretation of who Sam is and what the relationship is. And Sam, in the short story and in the play, is the character who gets recruited to help solve the mystery across the way. And this bond forms between Jeffries, played by Kevin Bacon, and Sam, played wonderfully by a young actor named McKinley Belcher III. They form this amazing relationship on stage as Sam is recruited to do all those things that Jeffries can't do because he has a broken leg.
So one of the things, Keith Radin, that is complicated, and it's interesting because as I saw the play, one of the people that I saw it with afterwards, I was sort of saying, wow, you know, just even having this kind of homoerotic subcurrent, undercurrent between Kevin Bacon and McKinley Belcher that's pretty amazing and pretty startling and pretty paradigm shifting. And the person I saw it with, who's a keen observer of theater, ordinarily said, are you really sure that that's what was going on? I said, yes, that wasn't subtle at all. No, but I think once again, it's abundantly there in the script, but you have to go like 175% because somehow or other you're still fighting that tide of the deeply heterosexual Jimmy Stewart, Grace Kelly relationship. But talk a little bit about why you decided to go the way you went between Sam and Jeff in this.
Well, again, I think it gets back to the life of Cornell Woolrich and what he was, I think, writing between the lines, which was this kind of homoerotic sexuality that's very subtle and that I think is there in his life and in his writing. I mean, in the story, he talks about, Sam, get me those binoculars from that cruise we took together. Mm-hmm. Or, Sam, do you remember when we spent that time together? So there's clearly, even in the story, references and suggestions that it's more than just somebody that he's hired to help him do chores. And I felt that, again, that given that the audience sensibility is, I think, more sophisticated in that way of the sexuality, that they would be accepting of that, and that what is, I think, implicit in a lot of his stories could come out, literally, you know, mm-hmm. come out. It's interesting, though, I overheard two patrons, an older couple, and the guy said, wait, during the show, he was like, wait, there's no Grace Kelly character. And the woman said, no, the black man is the Grace Kelly character. And in a way, he is our love interest beyond,
oh, yeah.
you know, helping him out with these chores.
Oh, I feel that absolutely. And then, Charlie, the other thing that's happening there is kind of a hashtag Black Lives Matter undercurrent here. And I mean, in a way, for me, the way I processed this anyway was this is also a play, a work about how vulnerable we are and how vulnerable we are in chaotic urban settings.
Yeah.
So for the Kevin Bacon character, you know, I mean, this is a time where it was really dangerous to be gay. You know, you had to be careful who you said what to. And Cornell Woolrich certainly lived a life in the 20s and 30s where being gay would have been problematic and dangerous for him. But also what you feel, though, is that Sam is coming out of a whole other environment where, like, I spent a lot of this play worrying about Sam in a different way than I would have worried about Grace Kelly, because I feel like, well, it's very clear in the way that Keith has written it. Sam could get beaten up or killed by any number of people, not just Lars Thorwald.
Sam was our beacon of morality in the piece, and he was a reflection of our worst tendencies. And we are very comfortable with the notion that human character may improve, but it doesn't necessarily go away. And the fact that current events have sort of walked all over something that we've been in process with for a number of years is actually coincidental.
Mm-hmm.
That the fact that the narrative is so shrill and the sensitivities are so irritated right now just sort of coincides with our belief that, my God, can you imagine what it was like to manage those behavioral and existential issues in that time?
Yeah, that's. I'm amazed to hear you say that that was in the works for a while. And Keith, maybe you could say a little bit more about this, because once again, no real spoiler intended here, but Boyne, who's the cop, who's the character who has survived from the short story, he's, you know, so he's the leading cop in this story. He has this whole other separate interest in Sam. Like, he would like to do something to Sam. He's menacing towards Sam for reasons kind of unrelated to the rest of the plot. So as Charlie's saying, so you had that in there even before it became front and center in the national dialogue the way it is now?
Yeah, we've been working on this for clearly over 2 years now. And when that happened, it wasn't with the idea of pushing any kind of social, political agenda. What I realized in doing the research of that time period was, if we set the play at the time that the short story was written, and my feeling is if a cop came in and there's a young black guy standing there, you know, that they're not going to necessarily have a polite conversation, that there is a real jockeying of status, and the police force, again, doing the research of that period, was being accused of all kinds of racial mistreatment that echoed, I felt like, what hasn't changed, unfortunately. So it was a it really was a coincidence, sadly, that events sort of overtook what we were doing in terms of a plot.
We got about a minute left. Jay, what was the cell like for Kevin Bacon? In other words, you or Charlie, I don't know who had this, who knows more about that conversation, but you're saying to him, yeah, you're going to play this iconic role, except not. It's going to be like a Tennessee Williams character injected into an Alfred Hitchcock movie. Was he eager right away to do that?
Well, I've been friends and colleagues with Kevin Bacon for over 30 years, so the conversation was easy for me to broach with him. And his first question was, is this going to be a new character? And I said, yes, it is. So that's why we would love you to read it, because you're the sort of actor who can bring something new to this and create your own character. And he said, okay, I'll read it. Because if I had said to him, you know, oh, well, this is just a rehash of something you already know, he wouldn't have been interested. It was because we were not doing a cover song of the film. That's why he was interested.
We're going to have to stop it there. I will say, though, I had all kinds of weird expectations and maybe even an inclination to resist Kevin Bacon. He's really amazing, actually. He's really, really good.
Yeah.
Maybe better than a lot of people are giving him credit
standard
for right now. Yeah. So anyway, thanks very much to David Thompson, who's not here anymore, but to Keith Radin, the writer of the adaptation. Charlie Lyons and Jay Russell are the producers of the self-same Rear Window at Hartford Stage, running through the 15th. Good luck getting in. But maybe it'll go someplace else. Maybe in another city you'll have a chance to see it and pay a lot more money.
Greg, come here.
What?
Look through that window. See, that woman is editing a manuscript, but the guy who wrote it is coming to kill her, and only that old lady can stop it.
That's not a window. That's your TV. You're watching Murder, She Wrote.
Oh.